Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for July the 23rd. Now, you may have heard that British broadcasting's been under something of a cloud this past week. Faked phone-ins, dodgy editing, journalistic shortcuts. Well, I can assure you, everything you're about to hear today is happening live and with the utmost honesty and integrity. Really, it is. Coming up on this week's show, nuclear physicist Jim Al-Khalili joins us in the pod to discuss atoms, matter, and the world's heaviest elements. We hear from the American philosopher Dan Dennett on theories of consciousness, plus the truth about a new breed of super ape, and the science and psychology of chat-up lines. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Okay, well, journalism's under the spotlight. Yes, we're talking about you, the BBC, but here to uphold the Guardian's values of impartiality, honesty, and liberal lefty E, we have, looking grisly and sounding angry, science correspondent James Randerson.
I have to admit that I'm not actually me. I'm one of the massive production team pretending to be me.
You know, I always thought that. No one can grow a beard that quickly. And welcome back to Science Weekly producer Ben Green. Ben, you're not going to do any producery jiggery-pokery today and deceive our dear listeners, are you?
I wouldn't possibly dream of it. However, I am going to play us a song to link us into our first story and talk about one of our favourite themes on the show, which is your hair.
Ben, you bad boy. Our special guest this week is a theoretical nuclear physicist at the University of Surrey. He's an author and a broadcaster, but that's just the start. His portrait is hanging in the National Portrait Gallery, and he was recently awarded the Royal Society's Faraday Prize for Science Communication. This week, he'll be presenting a new series called Atom on the BBC as part of the Science You Can't See season. Jim Al-Khalili, welcome to the pod. What is it you mainly do? I mean, are you a science communicator? Are you a nuclear physicist, TV presenter? The list goes on.
Oh, just life is so hectic. Well, I'm a physicist, first and foremost, so my day job is lecturing and carrying out my research. But I've got this lovely dual role at Surrey University where I'm also a professor of public engagement in science, which means they allow me to spend part of my time going out and talking to the public and doing TV and radio when I can. So it's a very nice mixture.
And this programme you've just made, Atom, for BBC Four, tell us a bit about it. It's the history of nuclear physics, which must have been quite difficult to condense down. It's just, what is it, three programmes?
It's 3 one-hour programmes, yeah. I mean, it's great fun. I wouldn't have believed that the BBC would commission a whole series about nuclear physics and quantum mechanics, but there you go. It was great fun to try and tell the whole story. What was nice was my director, Tim Usborne, is also a physicist, and so between us we sort of managed to sort of knock together a script to tell a nice story.
Two geeks telling a tale. Excellent.
Oh, yes.
So tell us where it starts. Ernest Rutherford is the sort of father of this discipline, basically, isn't he?
He is, yes. So we start the story about 100 years ago when people like Rutherford and Marie Curie were first starting to study this strange phenomenon called radioactivity. And really, at the time, no one even knew whether atoms existed or not. So they were trying to figure out not only that atoms were real, but whether they were actually made of something, whether there was a substructure inside atoms.
And what did he do to try and find out? What was inside atoms?
Essentially, he took a sheet of metal and bombarded it with alpha rays, which is radioactive particles that come out naturally from certain materials. And he watched, using a new device which then became what we now call a Geiger counter, to see how these alpha particles bounced off the atoms in the metal. And just from the angles that they bounced off, he was able to figure out what an atom looks like, that it's got its tiny nucleus at the middle, and the rest of it is just empty space with electrons whizzing around. So this model that you learn at school about a planetary model of the atom, that's what Rutherford first discovered.
And so began nuclear physics. James, you've got a question.
How did people think that atoms looked like before, if you say that?
Well, until a few years before that famous experiment from Rutherford, people didn't even know for sure whether atoms existed. There was this argument among scientists, maybe you could chop matter up again and again, smaller and smaller, and just keep going forever. You would never reach a fundamental building block. Once they'd figured out that, yes, atoms existed, the only other model around was that it was something called the plum pudding model of the atom, because they knew atoms had these little particles called electrons inside, which carry negative electric charge. but they didn't know how they were distributed, so they assumed the atom was like a little ball, like a pudding, with all these electrons distributed around it, in like plums.
So a rather sort of astonishing insight from this experiment is that most of the atom is empty space. And actually, I was looking at your the book of the series earlier on today, and there's something in it that is, I don't know, really quite striking, that if you were to take out all of that empty space, you'd have something that weighed the same as your body, but it would be the size of a grain of salt.
Yes, you could take out all the space that's just extraneous space inside atoms.
Utterly mind-blowing. I remember, you know, being told that in chemistry and finding it mind-blowing then, and I still find it mind-blowing now. It seems like magic to me.
There's plenty of magical things about atoms that I can go on for ages on.
Things got even more mind-blowing after that, didn't they? With quantum mechanics. I mean, people, if Rutherford thought to himself, right, that's it now, I've discovered the structure of the atom, there's a nuclear and most of its space, then it just got just weird after that, didn't it?
Yeah, you see, Rutherford was an experimentalist, so Rutherford worked in the lab and he was very hard-nosed and pragmatic. He wanted to know what these tiny things looked like. What he did was bring along to help him the Danish physicist Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr is a mathematician, so he was trying to develop mathematical models of what an atom is. And in doing that, he developed this whole new theory of science called quantum mechanics, which
just
essentially...
Just by chance.
a lot of the discoveries were very, very surprising, and a lot of them are just so mind-blowingly confusing that, you know, you wouldn't have thought they'd come up, but they all came by accident. It wasn't just Niels Bohr. He gathered around him a group of young geniuses and developed this new theory. They sort of left Rutherford sort of far behind, and, you know, they just went off on a tangent.
A famous scientist said that if you think you can understand quantum physics, then you probably don't.
That was our man Niels Bohr.
Was it? Yeah. So do you understand quantum physics?
Well,
I hope you do.
That's a loaded question, if ever I heard.
Yes, and my students will be very upset if I say no, I don't. What have you been doing all this time? Well, I've got the theory of quantum mechanics, the mathematics, is well understood. And, you know, without it, we wouldn't not only be able to explain what atoms are, but we wouldn't know anything about how atoms fit together to make the world. And so the whole of modern physics and chemistry and electronics, we wouldn't have computers, we wouldn't have silicon chips, we wouldn't have a lot of modern-day technology if quantum mechanics wasn't right. What we don't understand is how the hell it does work the way it does. You know, if you go beyond the maths and say, well, what is really going on? That's where it gets really weird.
So these days, people have taken on essentially the same idea that Rutherford was using, bombarding particles at other particles and smashing them up and seeing what's left over. Of course, these days they do it at much higher energy and at vastly massive cost. So what's the sort of latest that people are looking into now?
Well, what's exciting now is, as I mentioned, it's the same as Rutherford's original idea. You take particles and you bombard them like bullets at an atom and try and see how they bounce off the nucleus. And just from the angles, the way they break the nucleus up, some of them get embedded in it, you can figure out a lot about the properties of that nucleus. What's happening today is that nuclear physicists are studying atoms that don't hang around long enough to stick them in the beam of these particles. They only live for fractions of a second. So they do everything in reverse. They keep the bullets sort of hovering in midair, as it were, and fire the whole atom at them, or the atomic nucleus. And they do everything. It depends on your frame of reference, really. Mm-hmm. But
well, it's all relative anyway. So,
there you go. Yeah. And so it's a sort of backwards way of studying these what are called exotic nuclei.
And so you wind up with these things that just wouldn't exist in nature otherwise.
That's right, because they would have, you know, if they did exist, they only exist for a fraction of a second and then sort of decay away into something else.
What's so exotic about these nuclei?
Well, an atomic nucleus is made of two kinds of particles, protons and neutrons. And sort of all the textbooks for the last nearly 100 years tell us that if you put protons and neutrons together, you make all the elements and you get different isotopes of different elements depending on the balance. What we can do now is overload a nucleus with many more protons than it should have, or many more neutrons. And once this imbalance gets really extreme, the nucleus takes on rather strange properties. So, for instance, you might get one or two neutrons floating around the outside of a nucleus. And the same way you think of an atom with electrons floating around the outside of the nucleus, well, you get neutrons going around, orbiting around. And, of course, they shouldn't do, because there's nothing, the glue that holds them into the nucleus shouldn't extend out outside it. So they should just fall away, but they don't.
Can you explain that using normal physics?
Oh, yes. You can explain this using quantum mechanics. If it wasn't for quantum mechanics, these things wouldn't exist. Quantum mechanics says they can exist, as you know, in this strange behavior, do these strange things, provided they only do it for a short period of time. That's allowed. Quantum mechanics allows this fuzziness something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there for now. We'll talk more about exotic nuclei and that kind of thing a bit later. Thanks, Jim. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we're going to tell you more about the lion-eating chimps of the Congolese jungle, plus philosophy of the mind and philosophy of the soul. We hear from one of the world's leading minds, Professor Dan Dennett. First, though, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines for the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
The government should reconsider its decades-long ban on sending Britons into space, according to MPs. They warn that an outright rejection of human spaceflight will lead to the UK being unable to take part in future international missions and weaken the country's standing in space science.
Sonar images of the English Channel have revealed that a cataclysmic flood 400,000 years ago cleaved Britain from France. Scientists say a deep scar in the seabed is evidence of a violent act of nature that carved out the white cliffs of Dover and created the English Channel. Vive la France!
New homes and schools should not be built within 60 metres of high-voltage power lines until the link with childhood cancers is better understood by scientists, according to an investigation by MPs. They said that, though the science was still unclear and that any health effects are weak, the government should adopt a precautionary approach.
And finally, psychologists have shed light on one of the most enduring mysteries of human courtship, why men persist with chat-up lines that send most women running for the high hills. A survey revealed that women were more likely to favour lines suggesting that a man was a nice guy, whereas men were always over-optimistic that women would find them irresistible if their opening gambit was sexually explicit.
And that was your News Jam. James and Ben, thank you both. A couple of things we can pick up from their stories. Jim, can I ask you first, what do you think about sending people into space?
Depends who, really.
I mean, for science research, rather than people you want to get rid of.
Well, I mean, there's so much. It's a shame that it's not since the late 60s that we've had people go off, out of Earth orbit to visit the moon, and we haven't actually reached Mars yet, and we keep talking about how long in the future before that'll be. The expense is vast, of course, but I can't imagine that it's going to happen sooner or later. And I think when the will is there, the technology is there, I think it's very, very exciting, and I think it's very important.
We've talked about this a lot in the pod before, but one of the things that I would say is a really good idea is that if sending people, especially Brits, into space, it would encourage more people to do science, universities and schools, because it's kind of a inspiring thing. How do you feel about that? I mean, part of your role is to do exactly what I'm suggesting, which is to inspire kids to do science. This is a really good way of doing it, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think with kids, the two most fascinating things about science are dinosaurs and space, and certainly having astronauts and maybe British astronauts is something that really would inspire a young generation. It is very important. I mean, you can't justify getting sort of a multi-billion pound budget to send people into space just to inspire school kids, but that would certainly be a very important spin-off.
James, can I ask you about the power line story? Are the MPs right to suggest that the government takes a precautionary stance with this?
It's a difficult one, this, though, genuinely, because the science is still very confused. There's conflicting evidence on either side. I mean, there was one particularly influential piece of science a couple of years ago called the Draper Report that was published in the BMJ, I was going to say the BMP then, but that's not quite right, British Medical Journal. And it was essentially a kind of postcode analysis looking at cancer cases and looking at where they were in the country with some control groups as well. And they found that, if your postcode is within 200 metres of a power line, you were sort of 70% more likely to have a case of childhood leukaemia. Now, that doesn't equate to a very large number of kids. Something between 2 and 60 kids a year might be attributable to power lines on that kind of evidence. But the costs are vast, and if you start, saying that power lines, sending out signals as a government that power lines are really dangerous, then the sort of, depreciation you'll get in the housing market around power lines is, pretty significant. So, one feels as if perhaps, they have to be pretty sure before they start going down that route.
Well, you're never sure in some bits of science. Jim, what do you think of the precautionary principle, especially in this case?
I can't say that I'm an expert on this, but I haven't seen anything in acknowledged, respectable science that would suggest there really is a risk here. I mean, I agree that people say, well, if you don't know, then better safe than sorry. But there's, I mean, it's the same as the mobile phones issue. There's no science yet that's going to convince me that there's any problems.
The best evidence that there is epidemiological, and nothing has been able to back that up in terms of what the mechanism might be or, you know, what's going on. And even the epidemiological evidence is these kind of population studies are conflicting. Not all of them show an effect. So I think you're right that, you know, we really don't know. I think that in this particular case, the evidence is slightly stronger than the mobile phone case. But then, you know, you can argue that actually there's been a lot more research on mobile phones. And so, you know, and maybe it's something to do with that, but it's still pretty confused.
All right, well, let's end on a slightly more upbeat note. Ben, what are those chat-up lines that you were talking about just now?
Well, it seems that there are four different types of chat-up line that men like to use, and it basically relates to the way that they try to convey themselves, the impression that they like to give them themselves. So you have people attempting to appear cultured. It's moments like these when I'm reminded of Byron. It's one of your favourites, James.
Yes, strange has never worked. Yeah.
To the meaningless compliment, one of your favourites, Alok. Did it hurt when you fell from heaven? To the overt sexual reference. I may not be Fred Flintstone, but I bet I can make your bed rock, baby. To the humorous.
I really, really could never see that working.
To the humorous. Hi, how do you like me so far? Which I don't think is particularly funny, actually.
No, I like that one. I think that's really good.
And maybe that's why you're married.
All right, we'll leave that there. Remember, we want to know what you think on all of this. If you've got anything to add on any of these topics, head to our brand spanking new science blog. That's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. You can abuse James there directly. A race of super apes has been discovered deep in the Congolese jungle. According to local legends, the beasts kill lions, catch fish, and even howl at the moon. Eyewitnesses say they're the size of a yeti and a hybrid between chimps and gorillas. Speaking of which, James Randerson, you've been covering this story, haven't you?
This has got to be the most hyped primate story in the history of primates.
Which is why we're giving it more coverage.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I love it, though. I mean, I kind of wish it was all true. Elements of it are true,
getting back to that BBC thing now. Be careful.
You're about to hear which elements. No, I talked to Cleve Hicks at the University of Amsterdam, who's spent 18 months out there in the jungle studying these guys, so this is what he had to say.
Back around the turn of the last century, several gorilla skulls were found in the Bondo region, and it's thought that they came from the area, I believe about 600 kilometers from the nearest populations of gorillas on either side. And because of that reason, it is possible that a relic population of gorilla, which would be called Gorilla Gorilla ualensis, might have lived in the Bondo region up until at least 100 years ago. Jeroen and I went and surveyed around the Uele River, and we found only abundant evidence of ground nesting chimps. We didn't find any gorillas. So if there were gorillas there, at least to the south of Beli in the Uele River 100 years ago, they're gone now. There could still be some further west. These chimps make about 21% of their nests are ground nests. And that's interesting because normally that's sort of a feature of gorillas, is that they sleep on the ground. Of course, female gorillas often sleep in the trees as well. There are a few other populations where chimps will actually make ground nests too, but usually it's something like 6% of nests, and that's only in one or two localities. In most places, the chimps nest almost exclusively in the trees. We know that some of these nests are actually night nests too, that they're slept in at night in a very predator-rich area. So this was one of the reasons that Carloman and some of the other people that were working at the site thought this population might be very interesting and may even be some kind of hybrid or there indeed may be gorillas there.
It's remarkable that they're nesting on the ground, really, isn't it? Because with leopards and lions and elephants around, that could be pretty dangerous, couldn't it?
Yes, and the other sites where ground nesting occurs, big cats are rare or absent, and I believe in Bwindi, where it's been seen, there's one herd of elephants, but I think Craig Stanford told me they're not that common. And at Beli, especially in the Gangu Forest, there are elephants everywhere. So we still don't know how they can get away with this, but the article points out this observation by one of our most experienced trackers. He took notes on it and brought a paw back of the leopard being eaten by a chimp. It sort of makes you wonder. You know?
Well, that sort of taps into one of the most spectacular rumors, which is that they kill lions. Now, you don't have any evidence for that, but finding of a chimp feasting on a leopard does sort of suggest that they may be quite formidable animals.
I will say from my personal encounters with them, they don't seem savage or aggressive as they've been often painted in the media. They seem just like chimps, possibly bigger. We're not quite sure on that yet. You know, chimps everywhere do hunt, but it's only been seen once that chimps killed a leopard. That was, I believe, in Mahale, and I think it was a very small leopard cub. But this may be the first time that I'm aware of a chimp was seen actually eating a big cat. You know, we'd like to see it again. Unfortunately, I didn't give Legata a camera on that occasion, but I'm convinced it happened. We found what we think are leopard hairs at the site. So it could be that the predators at the area are just avoiding these chimps because they themselves could be attacked, and that might allow them to get away with sleeping on the ground. But what I will say is the one place you don't find ground nests is close to the human villages and roads, and that could be because the chimps are actually, there's one thing there that they're afraid of, and that's us.
James, it's a fascinating story. Are there any other super species out there, you know, super gibbons or extreme mongooses or anything?
Well, it's pretty rare these days to find anything big. I suppose, you know, there could be all sorts of things lurking at the depths of the ocean that we don't know about. But I think most of the new species that are going to turn up that are of any kind of size are probably things that we sort of were aware of but didn't know they were a separate species. Earlier this year, there was the Bornean clouded leopard turned up, and, you know, people just assumed it was the same species as the one on the mainland, but it wasn't. So, yeah, there'll be some out there.
Now, some of the most interesting interviews we've conducted on our podcast have been when we've strayed slightly outside of science and into the realm of philosophy. And there's no doubt about it, Professor Daniel Dennett is one of the greatest thinkers in the world today. He's written extensively about qualia, or the way it feels to have mental states such as pain, seeing colours and so on, as well as the differences between human and animal minds, and, most recently, explaining evolutionary reasons for the phenomenon of religious groups. Well, Dr. Susan Blackmore, who was on Science Weekly earlier this year, has written a book called Conversations on Consciousness, where she speaks with leading lights in the field of consciousness. Here she is with Dan Dennett, and she begins by asking him to explain the fundamentals of the consciousness debate.
Consciousness seems to be some kind of worse problem than many other problems in science. Why? Let me put it another way. Dave Chalmers says there's a hard problem. William James says there's a fathomless abyss. Is there really a problem? If it's not that problem, what is it?
I think the reason that we find consciousness so hard is that we have evolved to have a certain capacity for self-knowledge, certain access to ourselves, which gives us subjective experience, which gives us a way of looking out at the world from where we are. And this just turns out to be very hard to understand, how something can have that perspective and not be just a thing, but a thing with a point of view and with the capacity to reflect on that point of view and talk about it. And it looks as if each one of us is in a certain sense trapped within a point of view. I can't ever get inside your head and you can't ever get inside mine. And this fact, and there is some sense which it is just undeniably a fact that we have these perspectives, is not closely paralleled with anything else we know about anything else. It isn't that atoms have that sort of thing, or that molecules, or that volcanoes, or continents, or trees, or galaxies. The only thing we know in the whole universe that has this feature is ourselves. And we're not even sure about each other. That's the problem of other minds. It is an artifact, I think, in a good sense of artifact. There's also bad senses of that term. It's something we've made, something that's been made in us, and something that we are these artifacts. We have been created by the process of evolution, both genetic and cultural, so that this is true of us. And what we're now trying to do is to reverse engineer ourselves, to understand what on earth it is, what kind of a machine are we, that this can be true of us. We don't know any other machines that have this feature.
That was Susan Blackmore speaking with Dan Dennett. To hear the full interview, where they go into discussions about zombic hunches, free will, and whether lobsters or thermostats are capable of having a point of view, head back to iTunes or the website guardian.co.uk/science. And as an extra treat this week, our two other Science Extra podcasts are also interviews by Susan Blackmore for her book. There's one with V.S. Ramachandran, the director of the Center for Brain and Cognition at the University of California in San Diego, and the last ever interview with DNA legend Francis Crick. As ever, thank you for all your comments over the past 7 days. At the very least, they provide a welcome distraction from the working day. Let's start with Dariush Bazazi from Edinburgh, who says in his most exasperated voice...
Come on, Science Weekly, why not discuss the hypocritical nature of your paper along with The Independent leading the coverage on climate change whilst advertising silly numbers of cheap flights? Can you please discuss this in your next podcast? Oh, P.S., I think that Nell should become the speaking clock.
Well, Dariush, you can't say that we don't pay attention to our listeners. I got The Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam, to answer your complaint.
It's a fair question, and it is something that we've looked at. Different people at The Guardian have different views on it. My view is that I don't think it's hypocritical, because I don't think, certainly I don't write in my pieces, that you shouldn't fly. I fly. Most people I know fly. I think what we can do is we can point out the damage that it does and then let people make up their own minds. And so I realise there is an issue there, but I don't think it's an issue of hypocrisy. The question becomes, well, should we advertise flights given that we've written about the damage that they do? And again, that's a fair question. And I think the answer to that is that it's difficult to demonise one aspect of society which causes pollution. Yes, cheap flights are quite often used as an example, but does that mean we should be allowed to advertise expensive flights? Should we be allowed to advertise holidays that you require aeroplanes to go on? Should we be allowed to advertise goods which are flown in from all around the world? Should we allow Sainsbury's to advertise its Chilean tomatoes or whatever it's advertising? So once you start saying you can't advertise things because of the carbon content, I think you're on quite dangerous ground. And I think what we can do as a newspaper, or as what I try and do as a journalist, I can't speak for the newspaper as a whole, is just to say, well, look, this is the situation, this is what the scientists are saying, this is what the damage caused is. Make up your own minds and judge your own behaviour and change it if you think that's required, and lobby others to do so.
There's one thing to add to that, which is that The Guardian does offset its flights.
Very good, Guardian people. Moving on, Matt Brown from Manchester has given us this epic rant.
Whilst I listen every week and will continue to do so, I'm beginning to get disillusioned. First, you confuse patents with copyright. Now you're peddling ill-founded nonsense about antibiotics in food. Sorry to ruin a good story with facts, but the EU has banned the use of antibiotics in animals except for the treatment of disease. If antibiotics are used, there are strict withdrawal periods to prevent meat, milk, and other animal products getting into the food chain. To top it off, you suggest that cloning is not a form of genetic modification. I may be missing something, but I would suggest replacing the entire genetic code in a donor cell should count as fairly fundamental genetic modification.
Congratulations, Matt, and with that post, I'm delighted to say that you've become our pedant-in-chief, pod ombudsman and pedantry monitor. By the way, Heejai Cho, meanwhile, has become our token Korean listener who lives in Bermuda. Head to the Facebook network to claim your own special title. While you're there, you can suggest songs for our Science Weekly troubadour, Mr. Johnny Berliner, who's, by the way, celebrating his birthday today. The best suggestion so far is an epic rap battle between entomologists. All right, final word of the day comes from Sergey, who was perplexed by our discussion on disasters with Bill Maguire in last week's programme.
How annoying. I was looking forward to reading this article on disasters, but it turns out to be a pre-recorded radio show, and I can't even fast forward through the intro and the music to get to the interesting bit. The very word podcast makes me reach for my hoop and stick and go and make my own fun like they did in my dad's day. In the words of Chaz and Dave, get your grumble, 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 old man grumble. I haven't even got a pod to cast it on.
Words fail me on that one, but we can get more sense from our special guest this week, Jim Alcleely. Jim, let's go back to some of your stuff. The exotic material we were talking about at the end of the last chat we had with you, what use is it to science? When we produce these special nuclei with neutrons floating around outside them, what do you do with them and what do you learn from them?
Well, I think it's, first of all, importantly, fair to say that this has nothing to do with some sort of industrial applications or nuclear power or even sort of some kind of weapon. Essentially, what we're trying to do is understand how the universe works and how everything's built up. And there are fundamentally four different forces of nature. One is gravity, one is the electromagnetic force, which holds all atoms together, and then the other two are forces that are only that work inside the atomic nucleus. That's their domain. And so studying these exotic nuclei, how protons and neutrons stick together inside a nucleus, tells us about these two forces of nature. So it's telling us how atoms were made and how atoms are cooked essentially all the atoms in our bodies were made long ago, either just after the Big Bang itself or inside a star that cooks all the heavy elements and then has to explode as a supernova, spraying all its ash out into space, and that's how our solar system was formed. So it's a fundamental question. Where did we come from? It's understanding how these nuclei build up and fit together.
And do these sort of strange nuclei occur anywhere naturally in the universe, do you know of?
Well, interestingly, they may occur inside stars. One of the things that nuclear physicists, or more correctly, nuclear astrophysicists, want to study is how all the elements are made, how they're synthesized. And you have to study the pathway. So you start from light elements and you fuse them together to make heavier elements. After all, that's how our sun shines. It turns hydrogen into helium. So how stars fit atoms together to make the heavier elements is something you want to understand. And it may be that they utilize these exotic nuclei. And the only way to understand how elements like gold and silver and lead and all the heavy elements are made is to understand the properties of these exotic species.
And talking of heavy elements, the heaviest one ever created by man has been turned up in a Russian lab.
Yes, this is element number 118. So if you think, you know, back to chemistry lessons at school, the periodic table is 92 elements in the periodic table. Well, we've now reached element 118, so it's very heavy. It's one of what's called the transuranic elements.
And what's it called?
And it's called ananactium, which is, you know,
catchy name.
Yes, well, it's derived from the number of the elements, 118.
Yeah.
And it hasn't actually got an official name yet.
When does that happen? Oh. That's really interesting.
These things take years. We've named elements up to over 100. I mean, sometimes they're named after famous scientists. So there's Einsteinium. There's a chap, a nuclear physicist, who discovered lots of elements called Glenn Seaborg. So there's an element called Seaborgium. There's this international wranglings go on between the different labs as to, you know, whose turn it is. There's actually an element called Darmstadtium, because there's a nuclear laboratory in Darmstadt in Germany that discovered it, and they decided, and everyone agreed, OK, you can have an element named after the lab.
That's really interesting.
Maybe they'll call it Science Weeklyum.
You never know.
I think pod listeners should suggest some names for this number 118. Just actually, can we keep going? Can we just keep going to 200, 300? Is that possible?
What is interesting is that after this element 118 only lives for a fraction of a second. They're very, very short-lived. They're very unstable. So, you know, it's really hard to make them. You have to actually collide two heavy nuclei together and create this thing. And then you don't see it. What you see is the results of it disintegrating very, very quickly. But interestingly, it's predicted that once you get up into the 120s somewhere, there's what's called the island of stability. There'll be some elements that will actually be more stable and survive for a long time, long enough to make lots of them and actually do proper chemistry with them.
I think maybe we should call it the phone directory of
the 118.
Yes. 118. Actually, this is a bit of a favourite of ours now. We're trying to, through this podcast, understand what dark matter is. We've asked nearly everyone. You're probably the most qualified to answer this. Is it any of these weird elements that you're talking about? Could it be?
It couldn't, no. The one thing we do know about dark matter, and we're pretty sure it's out there, is that it's not made of atoms. So it's not made of the stuff that we can see. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called dark matter. It's clearly out there, and it's clearly made of some kind of exotic particles that are not the particles that make up atoms, but other as yet undiscovered particles. Otherwise, we'd know about it, and it wouldn't be so mysterious.
Damn it, the mystery continues. Thanks a lot, Jim. Okay, well, that's it for this week. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in the show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or our Facebook wall. I recommend the blog in particular this week. You might also want to know that Ben Goldacre, our bad science columnist, has a bit of a ding-dong with Tim Radford, our former science editor, about how science is reported in the media. That's our media podcast. For now, though, my thanks go to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, and, of course, our special guest, Jim Al-Khalili. You can see Jim's programme Atom this week. It's on BBC Four on Thursday, 26 July, as part of the Beeb's Science You Can't See season. More details on the blog. There's also a book to go with the series by Piers Bisoni. Next week, amongst other things, we'll be speaking with novelist Ian McEwan about what draws him to using science in his stories. You really don't want to miss that. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and I've been Alok Jha.
Guardian Unlimited.